Ian Bourne started his up very well last week. And now we'll move on to a very different topic, which is the impact of the housing benefit changes which were announced originally in the emergency budget immediately after the election, or almost immediately after the election. Almost from then onwards, there was almost total silence for about 2 months. And then suddenly everybody took notice of what was happening, and the press started to go quite mad. And in the middle of all of this, Alex was asked to do some work for the shelter on what was happening, what was likely to happen more broadly and particularly in London as a result of the changes in the housing benefit regime. So we asked Alex, who is at the University of Cambridge at the Centre of Housing and Planning, which I also involved, to come and discuss this, and particularly the London implications for it. So, Alex Duncan from Cambridge, he's also a case, so this is a very...
Very festive. Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much to LSE London for inviting me. I was thinking about the title that I gave it just on, as I was walking down here, and I thought, on reflection, that maybe calling it housing benefit reform was a little bit generous. I mean, what reform typically implies is perhaps an appraisal of the ends which a policy is intended to serve, a kind of view of the bureaucratic mechanisms by which it's delivered, assessment of whether it's the policy is being efficient, whether how well it links with other related policies, what ends it isn't achieving, unforeseen consequences, and so on. And those kind of aspects of what might be thought of as reform are pretty absent in the way that what we're discussing as reform today was brought in. These measures that I'm going to talk about today were brought in pretty rapidly and pretty unambiguously, I think, without being too partisan. You could call them just cuts, and pretty substantial cuts to housing benefit. And the fact, I think, that they were quite blunt, they appear to be quite a blunt instrument, were what aroused what Christine's already alluded to, was quite a bit of media attention, which unfortunately I think perhaps wasn't as illuminating as it might be. But among the most sort of striking bits of media discussion was the inimitable Boris Johnson's comment that the measures implied a Kosovo-style social cleansing of London. Now, I wouldn't take that view, but we were lucky, as Christine said, to have some support from Shelter to carry out a more measured review of what the implications might be for London, particularly where in London low-income tenant households will be able to live as a result of the reforms, and that's what I'm going to present today. But before that, I'm aware that there's quite an international programme and so on, so I'm just going to sort of summarise some of the key features of housing benefit and the kind of context of the reforms that were introduced last year. So housing benefits available to tenants in all tenures, so both of social public landlords as well as private landlords, and it's been around in its current form by and large since the early 1980s. So it's a means-tested personal subsidy, but it's not immediately transferable from one property to another because its rate is assessed on the property that you lived in and on your household characteristics at the same time. The fact that it's means-tested means it's not only available to people on out-of-work benefits, but also to low-waged working households, and of course that was given that London's so expensive, there's quite a lot of those amongst private tenants who claim housing benefits in London. And also given that the cost of housing can be so high, in some cases it can be the single most valuable cash transfer amongst all the benefits that a claimant might receive from the government. And one thing to note is that the claims are assessed and administered by local authorities, not centrally, so they're kind of separate from other benefits like out-of-work, you know, unemployment benefit and so on. And the fact that you have to apply for it separately means that take-up is relatively low amongst all those who are eligible. Perhaps only about half of private tenants actually go ahead and receive it. Well, the rest of my presentation seems to have gone blank.
So good.
Blown away. Ah, lovely.
Help improve the field. Okay, let's hope it doesn't do that each week, each page.
So the more immediate background to the proposals and the reforms that were introduced last year. Firstly, there's a change in the way that housing benefit is, the values of which you can receive in 2008 when housing benefit for new claimants in the private rented sector was renamed to local housing allowance. And the kind of key feature of this is rather than having moving into a property and then having the, what you can receive assessed afterwards, was the government setting official rates for different rental market areas across the country. So you know up front what amount you could go out, you could claim for a given size of property in a given rental market area. And those rates are explicitly linked to a kind of continuous monitoring of the range of local rents, which has been carried out by the Valuation Office Agency. So it's a more market-oriented system than the one that it replaced. So you basically know what you can get. You shop around if you can get something cheaper. Until recently, you were allowed to keep some of the difference between below the official rate that you could claim. And I think the other thing too that's really striking about the use of housing benefit in the private rented sector has been the use of the private rented sector to meet obligations to potentially homeless people. So when people are potentially presenting as homeless and entitled to assistance from local authorities, there's been a move to divert them into private rented sector supported by housing benefit. So that's partly what explains why we've seen fewer homelessness acceptances in London. And that has also meant that the profile of private tenants who claim housing benefit is actually more similar in some ways, or has become more similar to the profile of social tenants, so people who are long-term sick and disabled and so on. So the position, latter part of last year, is about 1.5 million private tenants who are claiming housing benefit. And it's a bit hard to assess, but my best estimate is that's about a third of the total private rented sector in Britain. The government has said 40% at some times, but it's something in that region, 30 to 40%. And altogether, in London specifically, there's about 250,000 private tenants who are claiming housing benefit for support. So the other key bit of context to understanding the reforms or cuts that were introduced last year to the cost of housing benefit to private tenants. So this thick blue line here, this is billions of pounds in current 2010-11 prices. So this thick blue line is the total cost of support to private tenants through housing benefit in Britain. So until about 2004-05 it was around 4 million. 2009-10 it was just shy of £8 billion. This lower green line here is the cost in London, so that's something over £2 billion 2009-10 was spent in London on HB. What's harder to know is exactly why it has increased. So clearly part of it is that there are more people who are renting privately and there are more claimants. Part of it is that rents have increased pretty fast in the last 5 years or so. And Steve Wilcox, who made the observation that actually the proportion of the welfare budget that's spent on housing benefits has remained roughly in line with the proportion that households spend on housing costs. So there's a sense that it reflects the rising cost of housing more generally. Recessions obviously put more people out of work than they can claim. And lastly, the big question is really whether landlords have adjusted their rents. So the rents are the maximum rates you can claim for are published on the website, updated each month. So a landlord who might specialise in there can go and look and say, well, what's the maximum I can get for a two-bedroom flat, so I'll set it at that. And there's evidence of people setting rents upwards, but also of evidence of people setting rents downwards. So that's a much debated part of why it's got so expensive. I'm not going to cover all the measures that were proposed, but these are the most significant in terms of the number of people they affect and the amount of money that they are intended to save. Mm. So as I said, when local housing allowance was introduced, There was a move to explicitly tie the maximum rents that people would claim in a given area to market rates, and that had been the median. And the proposal is that the change that's coming in 2012, well, that would be now the 30th percentile, so roughly the cheapest third of rents. And that affects people everywhere, that affects tenants everywhere, it affects existing tenants, so it will reduce their payments they receive. And that produces the biggest immediate savings. The second measure, which is particularly pertinent to London, is the introduction of absolute caps. So not just saying up to the 30th percentile, but saying you can't claim more anywhere, anytime, for a given certain size of things. So that's going to be £290 a week for a two-bedroom, £400 a week for a four-bedroom, and so on for other sizes. And this measure has been much more publicised and was much more discussed in the media, and it was certainly something the government did nothing, certainly fomented or at least nothing to discourage the perception of this being the most important measure, saying this is the £20,000 a year, £400 a week times 50. And actually that's probably not really borne out by the overall extent of its impact. It affects only about 15,000 claimants out of about a million who will be affected. It initially affects only central and inner west London. And only about 1,000 are claiming that 20,000 a year or above. Now another measure, which is slightly more technical, but and I think it's again received less attention, but in the long term is very significant, and particularly significant to the spatial implications I'm going to turn to in a second, is the fact that from 2013, instead of pegging the rates of local housing allowance, or HB, to actual market rents, continuously observed, instead they'll be fixed and then just uprated by CPI inflation. What we've seen in the past 15 years is that CPI inflation has been very considerably less than rent inflation. So if you look at the cumulative CPI from 1997-8 to 2007-8, it was about 20%. Cumulative rent inflation is in the order of 70%. So rents have pretty consistently outstripped CPI inflation. And what that implies is that that notional 30% will gradually actually buy considerably less than that, progressively less. And the degree to which it does so will be how much faster rents are growing than CPI. And also, the other thing noted in the principle, it unlinks the idea that that a benefit that's intended to meet housing costs should be linked to real market housing costs. So on to why this has... Oh, sorry, just to note some of the effects of the reforms. Obviously, current claimants lose £12 a week. It will increase income poverty for those tenants. I mean, people have made different estimates. We estimated it would move 84,000 households below the sort of minimum benefits line, i.e. £100 a week for a couple or equivalents. The IFS have a more sophisticated tax and benefits model. Estimated 100,000 children placed in income poverty. There's quite a lot of contention about the number of people who might be moved or find themselves having to move, find themselves evicted or homeless, and very hard to evaluate. But we estimate at least 100,000 to 200,000 in severe difficulties of one sort or another. Questionably, some landlords will have to accept rent reductions. Whether they do so will depend very much on how much alternate demand there is for rented accommodation. Are they obliged to let to LHA claimants? And in the longer term, and this is really the thrust of what I want to talk about today, is the diminishing range of properties available to claimants. So if a CPI, immediately from going from the median to the 30th percentile, in the longer term, CPI reducing that further. The question of whether landlords will continue to be willing to let to LHA claimants. And possibly will it also bear down on rent inflation? So if we take the amount that landlords can get potentially from housing benefits, will that mean that rents will go up less fast? The reason that there are spatial implications of it, and particularly to do with the distribution of poor and better off households within cities, is a sort of fairly kind of central axiom, is that the market price of housing is determined partly by the dwelling quality, so how big is it, how luxurious is it, but also partly by its location. So you would pay a lot more for a similar type of property in Kensington than for that sort of property in Hounslow. this, the implications of this are particularly kind of pressing in London for a couple of reasons. Firstly, there is buoyant demand for rental housing, and the kind of fundamentals of demand for rented property look very strong in London for the near term. So a lot of frustrated owner-occupiers, people with unreasonable incomes who might wish to buy but are kind of frozen out through unavailability of mortgage finance. Also sources of international demand, relatively rosy prospects in the labour market and the regional economy. Another aspect is that London is a kind of much more large and integrated labour and housing market. So the potential of living in one pit of the city, and you know, the kind of the choices of where to live might be much broader. Although people may, of course, have very strong preferences to live in one neighbourhood or another. London also has a great bit of income polarisation, a lot of very wealthy households and a lot of not very wealthy households. Reflecting that, a very wide range of rents. So the absolute differences between the most expensive parts of the city and the cheapest bits of the city are much greater. So it's not so easy for people to say, well, I can probably make up a £5 difference. So it's much more clear that that a setting of the rates will price lower income households out of certain parts of the city. And lastly, London, of course, has quite a complex administrative system. It's got several layers of government. And the system of the rental market areas that's used to administer housing benefit further cross-cuts that administrative boundary. So one of the things we wanted to do with this work was to explore how that might play out. So just briefly, how we tried to evaluate what might happen. The first step in doing this was to make estimates for a large number of neighbourhoods in London. These are pretty small areas, so lower level super output areas, about 5,000 in London with roughly similar populations and housing stock, but not rental stock. We drew on several different sources of data for rent levels. So we know from the Valuation Office Agency's own data the spreads of local rents, the 30th percentile, the medians, maximums and minimums. And they look something like this. This is for inner East London here. So what's typical about this is you've got a very flat bit in the middle. So about sort of 80 to 85, 90% of rents are pretty on that pretty flat slope there. And that flat slope is pretty well approximated by the difference between the 30th percentile and the median. And so we take that slope of property range of rents, and also the slope of neighbourhood average rents, and then order neighbourhoods within each rental market area on the basis of house price. I won't go into anybody about that, but I have to answer about that in the questions. And then from that median neighbourhood price within each area, we then estimate a lower quartile price using some of the data published by the Greater London Assembly. Now the next step beyond that was, so having that, we've got now 5,000 odd neighbourhoods in London with an estimate of the rent prices for different property sizes and so on, and a rent, and also the lower quartile rent. We also know for each of those neighbourhoods what the current and future applicable local housing allowance, housing benefit rates will be. And so we match up in 2010 the kind of current position. In 2011, when the first set of measures are introduced, and then again in 2016, after the effects of the indexation of LHH to CPI have been in place for 3 years, to see how those two match up, how much of the property roughly within that neighbourhood, how much of the rented property would LHH rates be to be sufficient to pay for. We're looking at quite a few different assumptions about rental growth, and I'll come back to that a bit later. And we use the Treasury's central estimate of independent forecasters for CPI. Now the critical part is we decide that a neighbourhood is largely unaffordable to LHA claimants. Either you couldn't afford to live there on the amount you get, the maximum amount of HP. When the LHA rate is less than the lower quartile of local rents. So that implies when it won't meet the cheapest 25% of rents, an LHA claimant, low-income tenant claiming housing benefit, is deemed to be unable to afford that neighbourhood.
And I'll give you just a quick, some quick comments on why we choose that level. Those, the rents data that we have are of actual current paid rents rather than offer rents. So only some of those properties will be on the market at a given time. Some of the cheapest of those properties will be inadequate or unfit in some way or another. It's important to note that there are quite a large number of landlords who won't let to LHA claimants. They simply won't take people whose rents are to be paid by housing benefit. So from the point of view, we say when the lower quartile price can't be met by local housing allowance, from the point of view of someone seeking accommodation, that neighbourhood is going to be largely unaffordable. So just a few comments on what we can then say about this in respect to London. What is important not to say, I think, is that it's not an estimate of the location or number of current claimants who will have to leave. So we don't know very much about the detail of the existing range of tenants, location, circumstances. We also, there's a great deal of uncertainty about what they will do and how their landlord will respond. Will they take the hit in their income, or will they move immediately? Will they find other ways to up their income, or so on? But I think at the same time, it's important to note that where areas are becoming unaffordable immediately, that does imply that where there are HD claimants, some of them are going to face pretty severe difficulties. So London tenants are taking a hit of £22 a week on average. So some people are going to find themselves having to make some decisions about finding new accommodation fairly rapidly. And also what we're not really able to do with the method we've used is to make an estimate of the amount of rented stock that's going to be available in the future. But for many of the same reasons there, we don't know what landlords will do. And we also don't know a huge amount about the, you know, 10 years from the last census. We don't know a massive amount about where there is and how much rented stock there is in different parts of the city. Enough caveats. So I'm moving on to the findings. So this is the position in 2010. This is where, so in the kind of grey areas are where we consider there to be a reasonable range of, we find there to be a reasonable range of property affordable to LHA claimants. And the orange areas are where the neighbourhoods are largely unaffordable. And it's roughly three quarters of London at this point, three quarters of neighbourhoods are affordable. So what's like sort of big, obviously big chunks of sort of expensive bits of the Surrey and Kent borders, more expensive bits of the northeast periphery, sort of scattered sections within the inner boroughs, and also parts of, Kingston and Richmond down here. Then to update that, and so what happened? So this is after, in 2011, we shift from moving from LHA rates being the median of local rents to the bottom third, and applying caps on very high rents in London. So the effects of the caps are apparent. So you can see lots of Westminster, Kensington, inner bits of Camden, Islington affected. And we've also seen sort of the sort of middle priced parts of lots of other boroughs starting to become unaffordable to LHA claimants. And then this is the our kind of central estimate of the position in 2016. So at this point, we're seeing some of the areas that were marginally affordable in 2011 now becoming unaffordable as the kind of buying power of that 30% was further cut by the kind of, by the difference between CPI and CPI inflation and rents. And actually, what it starts to look like to my eyes at this point is that rather than being the kind of spread of areas that are unavailable, it starts looking like the kind of quite distinctive patches of the city that are the only ones that will remain affordable. So the obvious one of that is in big parts of the east. So this is Barking, Newham, Bexley, and the kind of east part of Greenwich. So there's a lot of property there that might well still be available. Down here in the Wandle Valley area, sort of across Merton and Sutton. Big chunks in Lewisham. So almost all of inner London by this point is, we think, will be unaffordable to low-income private tenants. The exception being this kind of bottom end of Lewisham and here up in Southwark, which is around Bermondsey, I think. There's sort of
a line of through North East London, and also some of the cheaper parts of West London, kind of in Hillingdon and Hounslow and so on.
Sorry, what about Lambeth?
Lambeth is, they haven't come out very clearly. This is Lambeth. No, that's Lambeth there.
Right.
So I guess that's kind of sort of Cold Harbour Lane, and that would be like there's Crystal Palace down there, I think. But I've got a link on there, and all these maps are in the working paper if you've got particular interest in particular boroughs. We've got tables by particular boroughs as well. Just as sort of a quick check on whether what we're doing, whether these estimates were a sensible way to try and predict where claimants might live. We looked at the whether our current estimates of where they live by borough actually did line up with where we know they do live at the moment, because we have numbers of current claimants. So this scatter plot is, along here we've got, this is a London borough, each dot is a London borough. This is our estimate on the bottom of how much of the borough we think is affordable. And then this up here is the estimate of what percentage of the private rented sector in that borough is taken up by housing benefit claimants. There's a pretty strong correlation between the two, which suggests that using this kind of affordability approach is a reasonably good predictor of where tenants do actually end up living. Now, one of the disadvantages of showing it on a map is that it, because not all the areas are equal sort of equal density. So, kind of going back to the map, there's like some quite large chunks of the city are remaining affordable. Of course, being on the outer bits of London, they're also much less densely settled. So this, instead, is a way of looking. So just this first pair here, it gives you a sense of the decreasing proportion of the city overall that we consider will remain affordable as a result of the measures. So as I said, currently affordable in 2010, think about 3/4 of the city, or the city's neighbourhoods are affordable to claimants who are taking HB to pay their rent. What happens from next year with the immediate effects of the reforms, I think this will drop to about 51%, about half of the city will be affordable to claimants. And then with a kind of main estimate of what the future might look like, we think that will fall to roughly a third in 2016. So that kind of spatial picture is actually, perhaps overstates, because of the low density of the outer areas, how much of the city is going to remain affordable. So there's going to be a pretty severe squeeze. A cut of about half of the city that's currently is accessible to claimants will cease to be so. As I said in my comments at the beginning, the caps on the kind of most exorbitant rents have been the most discussed and the most salient feature of the measures. Whereas I suggested at the beginning that the move to the 30th percentile in the short term is kind of a more considerable change, and it's not only that, because it affects all of the country, whereas the caps only affect London. But this is just to give you a sense of what the effects just in London would be. So if the government had only introduced the caps on exorbitant rents, we'd still see about half of the neighbourhoods in London being affordable by 2016. Conversely, if they'd only introduced the change from, to use the median instead of the 30th percentile, we'd see that fall from about 3/4 to about 40%. So a lot more of the work is being done by that change in particular. And I think that what that also is, there's some of, I'll show you where that kind of that process of moving to the 30th percentile is making the changes primarily in these outer boroughs here, so down at Sutton or Richmond, parts of Haringey, Hackney, Enfield, Brent, and so on. Where the sort of middle market bits of those boroughs are being taken out of reach of HB claimants. Whereas the caps, really, as I say, initially will only affect Kensington, Westminster, and perhaps a little bit of Hammersmith.
The change to 2016 is the effect of CPI inflation. And of course, the big uncertainties is how fast will rents grow and how fast will how high will CPI inflation be. So it's really what it hangs on is the balance between the two. So I mean, if they're both low or they're both high, well, they'll cancel each other out. What's really at issue is the extent of the gap between CPI inflation and rent inflation. The bigger the gap, the more the actual real buying power of LHA will be eroded. So our central estimate, the one I've just shown you, was based on rent inflation of about 3.5% a year in money terms. So, and then with the CPI being 2.1%. That's pretty conservative. I mean, the rent inflation in London over the past decade or so, if you look at it sort of annualised, it's about 5 to 7%. Of course, that was in a relatively benign economic circumstances, a housing boom. So, considering that there may be, the economic prospects may be a little slightly bleaker the next couple of years, and also that that there may be some effects, some downward pressure exerted by these changes on rents. 3.5% still seems like a conservative forecast. But we said, even if we were even more kind of conservative about that and said rents only grew at 2.5% an annum in London, by that point that would mean 46% of neighbourhoods would be affordable in 2016. So the eroding effects would be on buying power of low-income households would be considerably less. If we went for a kind of more pessimistic from the point of view of claimants assumption and said rent inflation ran at 5% from 2013 to 2016, we're getting to less than a quarter of the city being affordable to LHA claimants then. And I think more than the values that are attached, the specific values of rent inflation, I think what's striking is the wide range of effects that has. Of course, no one knows what rent inflation will be. But the difference, even those relatively small changes in rent inflation relative to CPI, will make a very different, very great difference to the extent of property and the range of places that are available to low-income tenants in London. So, of course, a lot of people are interested in what will happen to particular boroughs, and again, the map doesn't show that particularly clearly. So I've picked out three groups of boroughs here that are likely to feel some change. So, of course, as I've said, this isn't an estimate. We're not able to make an estimate of, the numbers of people who will be uprooted immediately, or people, I'm not saying people will be, a vast column of low-income tenants will be marching into Newham in 2012. But what I am suggesting is that there will be very strong pressures for tenants will find it uncomfortable and may well be in severe financial difficulty in some of the boroughs, which are becoming really much more unaffordable. And of course, what will happen as LHA rates drop, people have to have, when people reopen their claims, let's say they find new work, their household composition changes, they have to move house for other reasons, their claim may then be reassessed. And if LHA rates have fallen, they may find themselves with a shortfall on an existing property. So just picking out there's kind of major boroughs that are likely to see reductions in the number of low-income tenants living there with the support of HB. I picked out Cammersmith, Camden, Islington, Hackney, Kensington, Tower Hamlets, Westminster and Richmond. And so all of those are the boroughs that are left with less than 20% of their neighbourhoods being affordable. I mean, some of those drops are really striking. So Islington, and for example, roughly I think about 80% of Islington we think is affordable at the moment. And I think most it's probably reflected in the borough's social composition and also its political composition, that it's got a large number of wealthy households in some parts of the borough, but also a lot of low-income households, a lot of whom will be in private rented accommodation. And that picture is likely to change very dramatically in the next 5 years or so. Similarly, Westminster and Kensington and Chelsea, LHA's been left with almost no accommodation affordable to LHA claimants in 5 or 6 years' time. And actually, I mean, the gamut of places that that will have little or no neighbourhoods available to LHA claimants is pretty much all of the inner London borough, traditionally inner London boroughs, outside of, you know, north of the river, so apart from Southwark and Lewisham. So although we find that about 20% of inner London remains affordable, almost all of that is south of the river, very little in central, in inner London, north of the river. Well, some of the boroughs outside of the kind of inner area see really big falls in the amount of their accommodation that's going to remain, that's going to be affordable. And those three I picked out, particularly notable, are Brent, Kingston-on-Thames and Sutton. So those are ones losing more than half of their current range of neighbourhoods by 2016. Now the other set of boroughs I've picked out on the right hand side are those which are likely to continue to offer quite a substantial amount of accommodation and have a large range of neighbourhoods available to HV claimants by 2016. Now again, we've got to be cautious about saying exactly what the behavioural implications for current claimants and future claimants will be, but I mean, it would be fair to say that these boroughs are likely to see, you know, because they will have at least, will be considerably more affordable, likely to see a kind of shifting inwards from neighbouring boroughs of low-income tenants over time. There will be quite big pressures for tenants to find accommodation there, perhaps in preference to a neighbouring borough, which has now become quite difficult to find accommodation in. So amongst these are, as probably you've seen from the map, Barking, Bexley in the east, Croydon in the south, and then so that northeast corridor of Haringey, Hillingdon and Hounslow in the west, and as I've already mentioned, Lewisham, sort of is on the sort of outer edges of Lewisham within inner London. So that's the sort of borough level picture. The last bit of analysis that we tried to do was to say, well, what do these neighbourhoods at neighbourhood level look like compared to the ones that the ones that are affordable now, the ones that are affordable next year, and the ones that might be affordable in 2016. It's probably not a great surprise, but it came out really unambiguously when we look at some of the key deprivation indicators. The index of multiple deprivation, JSA claimant rates, that the neighbourhoods that remain affordable by 2016 have considerably higher rates of multiple deprivation reversals, more claimants unemployment, and Kristen didn't really want me to put this in the paper, but I thought it was quite interesting. I also interesting to note that some of the areas that become unaffordable are also quite politically marginal at constituency and local authority level. But I think the sort of striking degree, what we looked at was how much it implies a concentration of households who, being low income, often dependent on state benefits for their main income as well as for housing support, how much those households are being moved to areas with existing high rates of similarly disadvantaged households. So it implies that some form of concentration is likely to happen. So just to illustrate that, this is a plot of the quintiles within London of the 2007 index of multiple deprivation. I'm just going to make it tally up with the other map. I've coloured in darkest the least deprived areas, and I've coloured in lightest the most deprived areas. So you've got lots of high deprivation areas of Tower Hamlets, Hackney, Lambeth, Southwark, north bit of Islington, and then also in parts of West London as well. And just to pull back to that, this is the areas, the light coloured areas here are the ones which we estimate will be remain affordable. So obviously inner London, for the reasons described, will become unaffordable, but outside of inner London there's a pretty strong match up with these sort of spreads of areas of high multiple deprivation in East London,
sort of trenches in North East London, in West London, and parts of South London. Yeah. So just to sort of close on that, I wanted to make explicit some what the policy implications might be of this, or what the, you know, what the kind of things that boroughs and welfare services and so on might need to confront. And I think the thing that's worrying the boroughs at the moment is the capacity of the outer boroughs, firstly, to meet this. And I think there's two senses of capacity here. I mean, firstly, is their capacity to meet the needs of disadvantaged households who are likely to be living in their boroughs in greater numbers as they find some of the inner boroughs increasingly unaffordable. So that has implications for things like school rolls. A lot of LHA claimers have children, and other broader welfare services are, for example, numbers of children on the child protection register, which is quite a labour-intensive thing for social work departments, but obviously a whole host of other welfare services. And the second aspect of capacity of the outer boroughs is will there be the rented accommodation there for claimants to find? And if not, where will those claimants go? Will they move further out and sort of overspend into the hinterland of outside of London? And I think the assessment of the supply of rents probably is really beyond what we've been able to do, simply because of the unknowns about what will happen to rents in particular places. Will people be attracted to add to the rental market, or will landlords withdraw, and so on? But I mean, it's a really enormous question. Is there simply enough rented housing in outer London to meet that? So, I mean, for example, Barking and Dagenham, which comes out as an area with lots of neighbourhoods being available, actually has very little accommodation that's in private renting, and almost all of that accommodation is already taken up by LHA claimants. So there's very little very little scope for LHA claimants, even though it might appear from the numbers I've shown you, it's for LHA claimants to move or to find accommodation in Barking, because there's not that much rented there. It's either social or owner-occupied. And the second of the sort of big policy implications really are more at a kind of level of national policy concerns. One of those, we're obviously very interested in getting people into work, and actually in London, this sort of mix of carrot and sticks that are applied to unemployed people actually has a bit more practical use potentially, rather than being simply ideological, whereas it might be in areas which have weak labour demand outside of London, i.e. that there may be real potential for supporting people through training and so on to actually find work if employment prospects are more buoyant here. Well, the question is are we moving low income households who might be seeking work away from the locations of employment, for example, a lot of low paid service work in the inner London? Is it going to become less attractive, less economically viable for households to take that work if they end up moving towards the outer boroughs? The second, and related to that, is the kind of cumulative effects of the housing benefit changes with other proposed changes to benefits and welfare, and other changes in housing more broadly. The government has been proposing to bring in a universal credit to sort of bring all different benefits together, so there are questions about how well will this integrate with that. There's been talk of a total benefit cap, so that no household will claim more than £26,000 a year. Well, since a larger household in London might well still be claiming £10,000 or £15,000 a year in housing benefit, what's left for that for your living expenses and for bringing up children look quite thin. So that there's sort of big questions really about that. There's big questions also about what will happen to the social sector, particularly if rent levels are more closely pegged to market rents. And then lastly, so specifically on the housing benefit policy measure, I suppose the questions are what are the mechanisms for monitoring and review. As I've indicated, there's a really wide spread of uncertainty about what the measures will mean for the availability of accommodation, the availability of neighbourhoods and spatial distribution of poor households in London. But there's not clear to me what are the mechanisms for keeping track of that and for reviewing the levels of LHA rates. And I just wanted to say some broad observations on what the policy might mean for London as a city and as sort of an object of sociological interest. I mean, I think what might be clear is that it's likely to accelerate the ongoing transformation of the class structure of inner London from having been a working class or a lot of working class people living in inner London 20 years ago, a kind of flexion in the population in London. Population of London starting to increase steadily from the late 1980s, and some sections of the middle class rediscovering a taste for urban life. And of course, that's gone really far beyond gentrification. Gentrification is a rather limited term, and it's also been accompanied by the scale of large-scale capital investment, private capital investing in housing in London, and large-scale private capital investment in housing in concert with state intervention in inner London. So it's not just private household activity, it's also capital activity. I think related to that is really one sort of interesting thing that's happened in the last sort of 10 or 15 years is the valuation of claims by people to support or assistance of various kinds based on sort of particularistic features like identity or neighbourhood. So I am from this community, therefore I'm entitled to have some support to live here. And I think the kind of the narrowing of the range is suggests that those claims are somewhat less to be valued. I mean, I was struck, the BBC did a programme on housing benefit reform, and their first move was to go to Stamford Hill to speak to some of the Jewish community there who have large families and many of whom claim housing benefits. And they said, "Well, it's terrible. We live near the shops that provide, we live near our places of worship, we live near our families and so on." And it really struck me that seems to be quite, that's kind of old speak. And those sort of claims are less to be valued or are, which is quite a striking, whereas those claims are really quite a striking feature of the sort of past 10 years in policy discourse. And the other thing, and again, it particularly bears on London, is that the changes imply a redistribution of the costs of housing market dysfunction. Of course, that is not entirely unexpected in housing economics, that the market should fail to provide adequate accommodation for everyone, for the bottom end of demand, for the people with least means to demand it. But that failure has been, or that failure to provide accommodation to all has been something that we've socialised the costs of and socialised the risks of largely. And what this measure seems to represent is a sort of desocialisation of that, and a shifting of the burden of that somewhat onto lower income households, both the financial costs of finding decent accommodation, but also the risks of having to move and unexpectedly and so on. So I will leave it. I look forward to your questions. I've said the presentation will be on the there afterwards. I've put some links to the papers that I've been discussing.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a fairly difficult issue to have all the elements of it. So one thing that might help a little bit start with is just to reiterate in a slightly different way what's meant by unaffordable or potentially unaffordable. I mean, the two definitions I ended up with are paying more rent than the welfare system in some extent expects you to be paying, mm-hmm. and therefore you are going to be losing out on other costs.
Mm-hmm.
Or the alternative version is that you will be paying a pound of every pound above that level. Could you expand a little bit on that?
Good. I mean, yeah. So, as I said, the definition of unaffordable is of neighbourhoods become unaffordable. It's an assessment of the relationship between the local housing allowance rates, that the maximum that anyone might be able to claim for, let's say, a two-bedroom property within inner East London. and what we think is the lower quartile rent in any given neighbourhood. Now, what claimants are not obliged to rent only properties that are that are below the LHA rate. So let's say that I have there's a property here, a two-bedroom property, and it's £200 a week. And the LHA rate is £180 a week. A claimant can still go out and take that property, but they'll have to find the difference of £20 a week out of their other income. Now, we've not assumed that claimants will do that, though in fact some do. But what we mean is that a claimant could not, when they were largely unaffordable, when a claimant could only find a very limited range or no property there available to them in a fit condition, without having to dip into their, obviously, means-tested basic other income to meet the difference. That's helpful, really, right? Yeah.
Can we have your name and then a question?
My name is Anestis Mandatis from Master of Science of Regional and Urban Planning. We're currently running a case study about Southport Borough, and specifically for Rotherhithe area. And I just wanted to ask, correct me if I'm wrong, we definitely need a Zoom in this map here.
We might have to do that, but...
especially, I checked the list about the areas that have a major change in the percentage of affordable housing. And Southport was not in that list. And it seems to me that as for the map as far as concerned, it looks in the color seems to be tagged as unaffordable. Whereas it still belongs to 20% of most deprived areas. So it seems to me like a tension, like a contradiction of this. How can it be deprived and at the same time less affordable?
The reasons that there's some quite surprising things happen in different boroughs. I mean, a lot of Southwark, as you can, this is Southwark I've kind of highlighted here. So there are big chunks of Southwark, and what remains to afford in Southwark is this sort of bit here, I think is Bermondsey type of area.
No.
And
this is
2010.
So
this is 2011. So this is what's unaffordable now, so the kind of, you know, the sort of bank side part of Southwark. And then I guess that sort of Dulwich part of Southwark down here. And then the orange areas are the ones that will become unaffordable in 2011 as a result of the measure. So, I mean, the reason that we see some quite surprising things happening in some boroughs is because of the way that the boundaries of the rental market areas for which rates apply. So different rates apply in different bits of London. For the purposes of the administration of HB, is broken up into 14 different rental market areas. And these cut across different parts of different boroughs. So some boroughs are in two or even three different rental market areas. So what you might find is that one part of a borough, you might be able to, you know, you might be in the most expensive bit of a very cheap rental market area, or you might be at the very bottom end of a expensive rental market area. So that's why you have some surprising things, I think.
So I guess this data, this list that you showed us, is in borough level, and you're talking about the changes subject to within borough level scale, right?
Yeah. So the neighbourhood. I've used borough level summaries of neighbourhoods to give a feel of what might be happening at borough level. But it's all built up from a neighbourhood, from the sort of small area neighbourhood level.
And one more question is about the Southwark again. As we visited the area, we found both evidence of housing, and some neighbourhoods also seem to be a little bit gentrified. And I'm asking whether this kind of tension is a typical symptom of the gentrification theory.
some of what is coloured in orange and red there are, you know, match up with areas that might be perceived as gentrifying in Bankside and Waterloo. As I suggested that this bears some relation or may accelerate what's been described as gentrification or more broader processes of urban change. But I'm not quite sure I can answer your specific question that way. Yeah.
Okay. Could you say who you are?
Sorry, I didn't know you were there. Okay. My name is Jennifer Braithwaite, and I'm a councillor for the London Borough of Lambeth. And what you just said is what we already know, but it's still terrifying for us. And it looks like if we are one of the boroughs which may be facing an influx of LHA claimants. And I'm not quite sure how boroughs like ours are meant to meet the actual demand, because we actually cannot meet the current demand for accommodation, affordable accommodation. Can you just shed some light on that?
I'm a prophet of doom, and I'm not really a solver of it, but I have a little bit better about that. And I think all that's going to help them do from a sort of the point of view of boroughs is to see where first, you know, give some sense of where might be rapidly turning unaffordable, i.e. where you might be finding tenants in trouble next year. That may be, you know, it's not going to give you exact numbers, but it may provide you an indicator. There are also, you know, DWP has given borough level numbers of the number of claimants who will be losing out, and I think, you know, I'm sure your housing team, you know, in Lambeth will already be on that, and that, you know, that will give you a sense of who's going to be, you know, who might find themselves in difficulty come you know, the sort of initial introduction of the measures. But I mean, what it comes to next is really where who will be owed a homelessness duty where, and that's still somewhat up in the air. That may be subject to change. And so, you know, if people, you know, where will people present, you know, requiring assistance, and which boroughs will have to house them, is a sort of open question. I think it, you know, is likely to change.
Okay. The link to that is a question which cannot, I think, be easily addressed, which is that, right, if people are moving into that particular area, then we have no reason to believe that the relativities of rents will stay constant. Well, inherently, this is assuming the pattern of rents remains constant. What you would expect to happen is that there will be more pressure on rents in areas where those rents are below what is administratively determined now, which may be different between these two areas because of this mismatch between borough and urban. So that you would expect to find that the bottom end of the system, the rents are actually going up, and therefore the actual payments of local housing allowance will be going up, and and the pressures on the system will become in some sense more even than this picture, but somewhat more frightening. If you wish to be more frightened than you already are.
I think we kind of considered looking at some of this analysis in other cities, and it kind of comes back to what I showed in one of the earlier slides. But, you know, I think that I think we're only able to take this view, the sort of static picture of the relativities of rents, given the sort of underlying prospective strength of overall demand in housing for London, that there are, you know, that if LHA claimants are priced out of the inner boroughs, there's enough people who are not supported by LHA who are looking for accommodation at those type of price levels in the inner boroughs, that are willing to pay something around LHA rates, i.e. so that rents don't then fall especially strongly in the inner boroughs in response to the measures.
They will fall, sure.
There
will be some space being available.
I think that's the latest. One behind you.
Thank you very much. I'm Victor Digby from the London Tenant Federation and the resident of Nyon Borough. Areas like Nyon Borough, Burton and Dagenham, Broken Forest, that you mentioned, and other areas that are operating already, some of those areas, we've got a generation going on there, which is destabilizing the community, the neighborhood, and families. And at the same time, the Olympic that is coming there, the market rate for housing, you know, pricing, costing, and everything is skyrocketing. And when you bring in this By the time you move, people move from Westminster, the Kensington and East End, we reckon that about 25,000 will be moving towards this area. So, have you taken into consideration, or what are the implications you think with the additional deprivation for that area in terms of you know, social mobility and then children in poverty, religion, and etc.?
I mean, I think my view, my assessment on the closing slides is that it will mean increasing income deprivation in some of the outer boroughs which have accommodation available, because people who may be moving out there, or who, you know, who are seeking accommodation with support from NHA are more income deprived. So it can be interesting. Oh, I hope we still have income still have deprivation indices in a few years' time. We may not still carry on producing that sort of data. But I think that may well happen. And we kind of did a comparison. I've got there's more detail in the working paper, which compares a sort of deprivation rates between where's affordable now and where might be affordable there. But I think it does. There are questions about that. And I know that some boroughs are sort of already contingency planning and assessing what it might mean for their services.
I think it possibly is, while it doesn't change the spatial pattern, one should slightly be careful of overstating the national picture, in the sense that the amounts of money which are going to go into the OHA are going to go on increasing for at least some time, even under the normal predictions. That doesn't necessarily help London, but London is half the money. So there is an issue in that context. Martin?
Yes, Martin Crookston, independent planning consultant. I'm doing some work for towns at the minute. I'm interested in that question exchange about would there be a market if people did come from inner London, assuming there's the capacity in outer London. I mean, I think it's very much connected. It's a labour market. I mean, it's very what is going to be going on. And I suppose my layman's suspicion would be that those flats in inner London would fill up with cheery Polish and Estonian kids who've taken jobs that people used to be able to walk to or get short bus rides to, and now won't be able to. But I don't know, Ian, have you any thoughts on whether that?
No. Well, I think that then, but also, I mean, the people who are sharing, you know, people who are in reasonably middle income paid employment who are sharing in London, I suppose I'm one of them. You know, I don't, you know, I might, well, my peers in regional cities might well expect to have, you know, their own, you know, self contained flat, whereas a lot of people who are in their, you know, in their 20s and 30s still live in, you know, living in shared accommodation. So I think they may, you know, but they may well be ready to snap up one and two bedroom properties, of which the large majority, you know, that's what most LHA claimants are taking. Mm-hmm. There may be quite large numbers of those are people who are doubled up or, you know, in quite, you know, we've got a lot denser in inner London in the last 10 years. And that, we may see some of that, you know, people that are moving, changing their circumstances in that way.
I'm assuming that will be a constraint on the dynamics in that end of the equation.
I mean, maybe an implication for London economy, which is quite different. But if to put the case against the summer, if I were a borough which I will name because I live there, Islington, the evidence on this is that I'm going to be very happy. But there is nothing.
Unless you're a Labour councillor.
Unless I'm a Labour councillor. In the sense that I'm going to get rid of a fair number of people who are costing me disproportionately in terms of my public services. And I'm going to get these nice young people who are bright and cheerful and use Upper Street. And might that not, you know, that might change the. We are emphasising, for obvious reasons, very much the outer areas and the areas which are going to take the inflow. But it's not an uncomfortable world.
No, nor is it a particularly inefficient world. I mean, you know, in terms of the efficient use of a public subsidy, if you treat housing, you know, if you say that from the tenant's point of view, you know, they're indifferent to where they live, as long as they've got a roof over their head, then it's an efficient use of public money to not to have them in Islington.
Thank you. I'm
My first name is Nelly. I live your qualification too from Professor Whitehead. Looking at this, your presentation, there's an issue this in your book about to make it a external issue. If say housing is being expanded in 2016, then or can we provide housing as say has no good, and then the coming issue of how to encourage people to live and live in decent housing. And there's an issue with my professor who I had about intermediate term or two. We get the one time range of 5 years, 15 years, 5 years from 11 and now until 2016. And is it possible that we can say improve consumption of housing for poor people?
I mean, I suppose just within the limits of this work, we've said that people may move because people are going to do other things, may adjust in other things to their housing money being less relative to their housing costs, which might imply a reduction in the quality of their housing consumption of low income households, i.e. the overcrowd or move to unfit accommodation. I'm not sure, Chris, whether you wanted to add anything on that, but
yeah, I think certainly if one looks at cities in other countries, one would expect, you said, yeah, they're normally looking for a two-bedroom accommodation. In many other cities across Europe, it would not be the case. The people at that type of income level would be expecting to be more crowded than that. And in central city, you know, if you say you are pretty crowded and other people with similar income are pretty crowded. So arguably, well, this is the government's case, but the system is relatively generous at the present time. If you think about a system which you quite rightly reflect as being one third of private tenants claiming and another third of private tenants having the right to claim but not doing so, even though for quite small amounts, it is a starting point of something which is really quite generous. Are these changes going to result in people having worse housing? Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, by definition, almost, because a proportion of the population is going to have increasingly less paid for them, dependent upon this CPI relationship to actual rent. So implicit in all of this is the argument about what's going to determine actual rent. And some bits of the discussion say, well, if you're taking, the government sees itself as a monopsony buyer in some areas.
It does, yeah.
In Barking and Dagenham, which I think was the 90% one up there, you know, 90% of the housing has got people in it who are getting LHA. So the rents are being determined by the availability of LHA in those contexts. So they're expecting to see some significant reduction in rents in some parts of the city, but we will get an evening out of that. But most of the estimates I've seen of the impact of withdrawing the money is not going to help the marginal tenants very much in that context. I'm talking too much. So one thing.
James Gleeson from the Department of Anthropology. Am I right in saying that LHA tenants aren't able to occupy overcrowded accommodation, or that landlords aren't allowed to rent out to tenants who would be overcrowded? Something I should know about by
Liv, I've put you on the spot, Liv. I've got Liv here from Shelter, who's a real expert on this.
So you get your, for the tenants, that they get an amount of money, and they, you know, they can choose which size of accommodation. If they make that choice, then they would do. And as far as the landlord goes, it would only be if they're statutorily overcrowded, which is those incredibly harsh definition that hasn't been changed since 1935 and involves people sleeping in kitchens, the landlord would be, there'd be any recourse against the landlord. The government says that, like, because there was a worry when this system first came in that it was going to incentivise people to own the crowd because they could keep the money. When it first came in, the evidence suggested that that didn't happen in big numbers. You know, as maybe 10-15% of people made a choice to keep more money, but not in great numbers. But that can only get worse with these changes, I think.
Yes, I was wondering whether more people would choose to occupy for credit on this one rather than have to leave the area.
I think that would be like the choice for a lot of people, won't it? They can either stay where they are and live somewhere in worse condition and more overcrowded, or move out. Yeah, that would be the choice that they're faced with.
Brian Hamm from the Dolphin Square Foundation. We're a charitable provider of intermediate affordable housing. I just wonder if we might spend a moment or two trying to tie this strand of thinking together with one or two other policy strands. In particular, what's happening with planning policies around affordable housing and the emerging kind of moment half-hearted support that's been given to intermediate affordable housing, whether that might be given an extra policy push that might help alleviate some of the tensions here. And the other policy strand around the new rules on grants or lack of grants from the HCA and charitable housing association providers charging 20% of open market rents and so on. Because I mean, I think there's three policy strands that are going to intertwine here. And I'm just interested in just wondering if you started to think about how that might all start to play out.
I think what strikes me is perhaps that some RSLs and some social housing is going to start looking a lot more like market housing, or becoming, you know, that intermediate space will look a lot bigger, and it will, particularly in London, I think, but, you know, that it'll be less, you know, there'll be a less clear split, and, you know, there'll be more shading along that sort of things, because the, you know, the subsidies, but also, you know, regulations about how rents are to be set. Beyond that, that'd be interesting to see who will be living in what has been called social housing in 10 years' time, if it does go that way. But okay, Kristen, you might have more sort of thoughts on the broader how it fits with other things that are happening in housing and planning.
I think there's so many things happening that it's really quite difficult. But they're obviously difficult. But I mean, there clearly are some elements of your world that see the potential move back to working, lower income working families, as bringing them more back to their traditional roles. It raises the issue of who accommodates the poorest. And I mean, we have been atypical as a country in accommodating the poorest in this way. It's not the norm in most social housing sectors. So I suspect that yes, there will be some more interest in that intermediate role, but I think it also raises the issue which continues to worry me, how long you continue to have a separate system for the LHA and the private rented sector, and completely guaranteed assistance in the social rented sector, which seems to me not to be consistent with your emphasis on the intermediate sector. But that's just me being negative again. I mean, three there quickly, because shall we take them together?
Okay, I'm Jason Powers, and I'm also a Westminster councillor. On that point, it's interesting that the housing benefit rules for the social sector will continue to be determined by the rent officer on an individual basis. Yeah. So each property will be judged on its merits. And if RSL start charging 8% of market rates in an area like Westminster, it'd be interesting to see what the rent officers take as the reasonableness of that rent. Moreover, there's the £500 a week overall universal cap that you mentioned, £26,000 a year. Because rents are so high in central London that still has a great interplay about what an RSL can charge, and ultimately would not be able to charge 80% of market rents. If we are talking about anything at all, dependent on state benefit.
So we move people from state, you know, the point you made about state benefits at the end, it becomes very, very much more important.
John Davis from Oxford, a quickie, are you assuming that movement out of Greater London altogether will be non-existent or minimal?
Well, a quick answer, I haven't really tried to assess movement, it's assessing the relative affordability of places, but I think, I suppose just in my closing policy implications implies that there may well be an overspill or movement out of London for some, you know, that there may just not be sufficient capacity that people will be able to find things within the kind of London boundaries.
My question was linked to what he was saying. If we look at the impact of this particular policy and the implementation on the other sectors, on the social rent housing in London, but also on the vacant stock, because in London it's rather large. And I wonder whether one shouldn't take that into account, because you're mentioning that on these grey areas, in fact, there is just not the stock available, if the rent level would be right. So, but there might be some of that vacant housing below the quality necessary to be occupied. No other ground here is starting. And where that stays in the equation.
The question, I suppose, what the mix of vacant property is looks like in London. There's quite a lot, you know, some of it, like you say, might be, you know, unfit, but also some of it, you know, might be kind of underutilised stuff that's notionally, you know, owned by foreign landlords, for example. In relation to this, I suppose it's hard, I suppose, to see that it will encourage landlords to bring more rent to market, you know, more properties to market that are underutilised at the moment.
Any final thoughts? I think the general trend of it is very obvious in terms of that CPI versus actual rent story is what really drives the longer term issues, and short term ones maybe less than we expect, but the longer term ones can be really quite frightening. So I thank you very much indeed for